Bobby and Ninkota were hunched over the dual controls of the skittering transport pod, trying vainly to wrest control of the vehicle from the combined minds of the Parolians. Blotting out the harmful pheromonic rays, which the aliens projected, was difficult, but not impossible. By concentrating on the image of the Antarian sapsucker, the Parolian's natural enemy, the two youngsters were able to make a crack in the mind shield and gain sluggish response from the steering mechanism. Still, the aircraft continued ever downward on a trajectory that would converge with the rupture in the space-time continuum which had been breached by the Algonquin hole. The wings of the aircraft glowed a deep phosphorescent blue as it plunged into the Earth's argonosphere. Heat from the outer hull seeped into the cabin, and the two adventurers shucked their space parkas. The vial of bug blood that Ninkota had extracted from the Queen during her sleep period, and the reason the Parolians were in such hot pursuit, had turned white hot and bubbly, threatening to burst. Soon Bobby would have to decide whether to abandon the ship and the mission, or whether he and Ninkota could weather yet another alien storm. Just 1 week ago, the Parolians had been sedately living a life of socially organized leisure in 66 contiguous ant farms in Roswell, New Mexico.
Ant farms?
Yes.
Wow.
It will all become clear.
I'm hoping so. That's exciting.
Yeah. In Roswell, New Mexico, as part of a covert research project funded by the Department of Defense's Alien Incursion Response Team. They had been living there since 1957, when one of their exploratory spacecraft had crash-landed in the nearby desert. They closely resembled common Earth ants in both size and diction, and likely would have been overlooked by the Air Force patrol that had arrived to investigate the crash, but for their sophisticated laser armament. After a minor "take me to your leader" misunderstanding had led to the destruction of their spacecraft by the trigger-happy squad leader and the reciprocal incineration of the squad leader, the Parolians had been transferred to AIRT Hangar 52 for temporary lodging. The scientist in charge, Milton Levine, built a 9-inch wide by 6-inch high by 1-inch thick containment facility in which to house and study the aliens. The Parolians took to it like magnets to a refrigerator door, and actually were the first space aliens to breed in captivity. So successfully did they procreate that Levine had to build dozens and then thousands more facilities. Eventually, he sensed a mass market appeal for his product, got himself debriefed from the AIRT, and went into business marketing Uncle Milton's Ant Farms. Using escape-proof... Using terrestrial harvester ants, the escape-proof and break-resistant ant farm containment facility was an instant hit. And for 40 years, it had been part of both Americana and national alien security. But then, a week ago, a peculiar distortion in the space-time continuum coupled with increased Parolian displeasure with the quantity of clean tunneling sand caused the unthinkable to happen. Socially organized leisure gave way to arthropodic anger, and 100 million metapleural glands simultaneously released a caustic formic acid solution that quickly nullified the ant farm's escape-proof claws. With tiny but lethal laser weaponry clutched in hair trigger mandibles, they systematically vacated their hermetically enclosed environs of 40 years. Their objective? I said it was unthinkable.
Well, the pause was so objective. I was waiting. I was ready to jump right in.
What I meant to say was that I can't think of it, at least not now. Maybe later, say next week, after we've all had a chance to recover from this, the 135th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar and all of its articulated musical appendages, not the least of which is the following unflambeaued.
Unflambeaued?
Essence du Calvos.
Essence de Orange. Essence de Squiggle.
Oh, is that what this is?
Yes, Squiggle. Music by Phil Burke. Back in a minute 12. Squiggle by Phil Burke. You make it so hard.
What? What's hard?
Thematically. Ant farms?
No, just ants.
Even ants. I spent minutes going through the collection of music to find something about ants. I found nothing about ants.
I found one, in fact.
What did you find?
Cut 12 on disc 1 here is about ants. And it's particularly... convenient, particularly because it refers to one of our birthday lads.
Excellent.
And I think it will all become clear.
Well, I hope so. Shall we proceed to find out how clear this becomes?
Please do.
Bunch for me.
Try to find a reason. Not to fit my job. Keep me till I'm hungry. Found a bunch to rock. Help me at your mind. Help me now and evermore.
Help me at your mind.
Thank you.
Marginal, absolutely marginal. Is that the best you could do?
Yeah, absolutely. It has the word ant in it, and I ran with it.
Good. That's our who's boy today?
Frank Zappa, born 1940. That was in 1940.
And
expired some days thereafter. Not before he gave us Electric Aunt Jemima from
very
Uncle Meat CD. But do go on. What do you have about ants?
I have nothing. I have piles of things here in the close. Well, here we'll just go through them between now and the hour when we'll begin once again our interview with Laurie Spiegel.
Begin? We have to start from the beginning.
We begin part two.
you would bring Symphonia Antarctica.
I believe.
Who was that? Is that someone that we don't play as a rule?
Probably. In the meantime, how about Fly Killer?
Yeah, that's right. That'll
work. It's an insect. I just have insects. I brought insects today.
Okay.
I looked for ants. Couldn't find any. You found Aunt Jemima. I couldn't find anything. Antarctica. I have something. Antarctica over there.
Okay.
But this is Fly Killer. Is that good enough?
Fine with me. Thank you.
Thank you. Crickets. There you are.
Ants?
The ants. The insect mix.
All right, that'll work.
The insect mix. I couldn't come up with any ants, but here's what we're hearing now, of course, is...
The famous
run out groove piece. Well, yeah, can't do that with a doggone CD. Just let that run out groove go. This is from the famous American Text Sound Pieces issued in 1977. That's Aram Saroyan's Crickets. There are lots of cool things on that old LP, which I have no idea if it's ever been re-released, but there's some wonderful stuff by John Cage and Charles Dodge and this terrific Crickets and a very, very funny piece called Give It to Me, Baby by John Giorno. Anyway, that's Crickets, R.M. Saroyan. Before that, Carl Stalling's Flea-Ridden Sheepdog.
Yes.
So Crickets and Fleas. And before that, an extended listening to part of Randall Wolf's My Insect Bride, inspired by The Fly.
And that was performed by what ensemble?
Oh, by the Common Sense Ensemble.
C-E-N-T-S?
It could be.
Yes.
In this case.
They're not from around here, are they?
They're from New York.
Oh.
Yeah. And then before that, George Crumb's Macrocosmos One, the movement called Scorpio. Does that count?
Sure does.
Okay.
Yes, it does.
And we had before that Andrew Walter's piece for flute and tape called Moth to Flame.
Yeah, it works.
So we have quite a few. And then we have George Crumb's from Black Angels, The Night of the Electric Insects.
Uh-huh.
And starting off that set, Nick Didkovsky's Fly Killer. So we have dominance of flies there, but electric insects, flies, moths, scorpions, generalized insect brides, but specifically the fly, and fleas and crickets.
Crickets. Crickets. Crickets.
You're listening to the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield. We got a backhanded compliment in the news media this week. How did it get phrased? If you think classical music is in the minority, wait till you hear cutting-edge classical music.
Yes,
something to that effect.
Another photo of us.
Of us. Thanks to Stefan Hard for the photo, and certainly I'm sure it must have been the hand of James Lowe in that caption. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, let's go back to New York City to our interview with Laurie Spiegel.
Now, how on earth do we pick up her thread of her storytelling, which seems interminable?
Well, we started by playing her piece Finding Voice. And then we'll bring in her voice.
Oh, good.
And she picks up talking about knobs and twirling things to make sounds and noises.
Oh, and I think this is the sequence in which we get to hear the famous Calvos and Damien at the Mouse.
I'm not sure if we'll actually be able to fit it in today. It's quite a long interview. I think it may go for 3 weeks. The section where we are actually playing the Music Mouse is quite illuminating. But also, for at least one of the two of us, quite embarrassing. I won't tell you which one of the two of us, but having brought it up. So, Finding Voice. Oh, as I lose mine, Finding Voice by Laurie Spiegel.
Thank you.
Now, of course,
So the thing is to take something which may require a great deal of forethought in structuring an interactive system so that you can get as much musical oomph out of it as you really want, and control as much stuff as you possibly can. Also, you want to be able to control a whole orchestra in real time in the moment and have it be meaningful. There's a great deal of preparation in that, and then you get to a point where you actually are playing the thing. And then, of course, you always run up to its limits, and you change it, and you run up against its limits, and you don't like the way this is coming out, and you change it. And it's a constant learning experience where you learn more about yourself. And it's a synergistic process that goes back and forth between composing and writing software.
The number of questions this sort of generates is enormous. I don't know how
I can ask.
Yeah, but how could someone I'd like to ask that?
Maybe you should just play some music and let them think about
But one of the questions is, if you take, and I don't know how to ask this so you can answer it in less than half a day, but if you take an information theory analysis of Mozart, don't you get a different result if you analyze it after it's been listened to a few times? And how does that change the emotional content? Because it becomes more predictable because you know it.
You get a different result aesthetically as a listener, but if you analyze it as an information structure, it's the same data.
But you talk about emotional impact in terms of predictability and redundancy and using those sorts of terms, and if we get more familiar with a piece of music.
Well,
and
the funny thing about music, and I don't really understand it, but it doesn't matter how many times I listen to a piece of music I love, I still feel it. So I think perhaps the feeling level of this does not get jaded with memory. I mean, there are pieces we all know that we've once loved and are now bored by, but there are many pieces that seem to stand up extremely well, and that's one of the tests of good composing, and it's one of those indefinable things that I don't know the answer to. But almost, as they say, pain itself has no memory. You remember the experience, but you don't remember the sensations.
Mm-hmm.
There's some level of music which the intellect doesn't seem to get in the way of, that can go through the same piece and feel the same chills going down your back again, even though you know every note in that climax and you've studied the score.
I can point to pieces in sort of music history that do that for me. I mean, certainly Stravinsky's Sacre du Printemps is one of them. I listen to that, and it doesn't matter how many times I get to the Danse Sacrale, I find myself caught up in the moment.
Yeah, caught up in the moment.
Now back to your music. You talk about both of those sets of elements, the information theory of the sort of intellectual component, talk about the emotional component. When I played some of these for myself, I found myself getting involved in them, and I remember when I first talked to Damien about Laurie Spiegel's music, I said, I'm not sure you're going to like this stuff, because this stuff sometimes gets too pleasant. And sometimes it doesn't have enough edge. And yet, as I listen to some of the later pieces, some of the pieces on your newer CD...
That early stuff, I haven't had time listening to it, too, but there were tremendous limitations, and a lot of things were very early. You're talking about the Expanding Universe.
Certainly, because that was my first encounter with your music, was Expanding Universe.
Yeah.
Some
kinds of music, of course, don't want an edge. They just want a lyricism. But that's a different thing. The technology was very primitive in many ways, and I wasn't able to have anywhere near a fraction of the kind of timbral control that everybody takes for granted with digital audio and electronics these days. And in terms of computer control, it was very bottlenecked as well. And I was learning everything, programming, and the whole thing was new. The interactivity was new on that level. But those were really pieces, and they were also done, don't forget, when you say Two Pleasants, at a point where the establishment really was all hard-edged, blip and bleep-type music, and heavily blues dominated, mm-hmm. and people doing music like Phil Glass and Steve Reich during that period, and Terry Riley, were... It was to work with tonal materials, modal materials, and motor rhythms was considered absolutely outlandish and radical at that point. So you have to have some historical context on them, as well as the technology being utterly primitive by modern standards.
You hold your head as
we... Oh, yeah, I can't bear to listen to those myself anymore, but maybe eventually I'll think of them as enough done by another person that I could bear to listen to them, but I don't think I want to. Yeah. Anyway.
Let's talk about something else. All right, let's talk about Music Mouse, because this is apparently, we're in the sort of technological universe right now where the world is divided in ways where I can't cross over a certain barrier to try Music Mouse because I use a technology that it doesn't run on. So tell
me...
That's
not true, because you're in my loft and therefore you can
try it. Well, I'm
going to
have that opportunity.
Well, why don't
we
just try that?
All right. Well, first, how about 2 minutes on Music Mouse and what it is, and then we'll go over and do it right here on the show.
Music Mouse is a program that I wrote about 10 years ago, started writing about 10 years ago when I got my first Macintosh, which was my first mouse and Windows interface type of computer experience. And it occurred to me, well, the natural thing that's so obvious nobody else does it, is that you want to just be able to shove music around with the mouse. And also, coming from my previous computer music work, I viewed the computer very much as a musical instrument rather than just a recording and editing device,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
since recording and editing were really barely possible when I was working. Well, I mean, we recorded functions of time. We didn't record music.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
But it's... Anyway, so I wrote this program. Of course, I started shoving the music around with the mouse, and then it needed a few constraints because, of course, it sounded lousy, but it needed a few options so you could keep changing, and it just kind of developed. And then a number of people who saw it or liked it and wanted copies, and then enough people wanted copies that I realized I had to just, you know, charge something for it or mass produce it to some degree because it was just ridiculous. And then it got shown at the Mac World Expo in Boston, I think, in January of 86. And suddenly, there were, like, rave reviews in all of these places. And Mac User awarded it a 5-mouse rating.
A 5-mouse rating.
Yeah, first music program to get one. And anyway, then I was stuck. And that's why I came up with the name... Well, actually, Keyboard Magazine came up with the name Aesthetic Engineering. They did a profile article on me in 86 called Lori Spiegel, Aesthetic Engineer, that Paul Lehrman wrote, and I thought that was a nice term.
It is. That's very... That means almost nicer than Aesthetic Engineering. I think you... Aesthetic Engineer. That's just... Terrific idea. Yes, that's wonderful.
Well, I engineer aesthetic experience.
Yeah, really? Let's move over to the mouse and take a look.
The mouse. Also, I should mention about it that there are... Well, I can mention what I'm talking about, but there are basically a lot of things which have ticked me off about the way music has always been done that need no longer be so. So I was really pleased to be able to put it out because it may, being an instrument that requires no conventional training, the most minimal physical coordination. If you can move an XY pointer, you can play Music Mouse. And just basically a good ear and the willingness to just be moment to moment and sound doing stuff. It's possible for just about anyone to play music, and that's a lot of the press it got, of course, has to do with the fact that it essentially makes it possible for just about anyone to play music, and it runs the gamut. It's had users from 3 years old through famous professionals. It's been used in not only schools and colleges and universities, but prisons. It's been used in
during interrogation.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right, for pain. It's been used, well, someone used it in the Philadelphia prison system, among others, that it's been used in working with juvenile delinquents, and said that nothing that they had found held their attention like playing Music Mouse. Nothing, there was nothing they'd ever come up with that they could do that held their attention and that, yeah, they got off on, basically, playing music. Then, of course, there's been a controversy because, of course, the constraints that I put in it tend to reflect my own personal aesthetic preferences. So,
such as? What kind of complaint would you get?
The common form is everything that you do might sound a little like Laurie Spiegel's music, or if you like Laurie Spiegel's music, this is a program you might want to make music with, or at the extreme end, this is just a Laurie Spiegel composition. I think Mark Kanter at Macromine said that in some interview, that, you know, Earl Brown or John Cage or Pauline Alvarez or other process composers would have considered it a musical composition, but Laurie just put it out and called it a program. And so it's been confusing because I got the first year I got a letter from some guy with a band who said, shouldn't this program join the musicians union because it's up there gigging with us, it does its own material, it contributes to the group in ways that are different from anyone else, and is it supposed to join the union or something? It's a member of our group. And then there was also a guy.
Did you pay the dues?
But of course not. No, it's just, I don't think people pay programs, right? You know. There have been people who come to me, you know, total strangers from my viewpoint, who say things like, oh, I'm so glad to finally meet you, and they'll come after a lecture. I feel that we've been collaborating as composers for years. I use your software, and I can feel your influence in my music, and I really feel that, to some extent, we've been musical collaborators. These are people I've never met before. Mm. You know, there is a feel in the program. There's, for example, relating to what I was saying before, there's a heavy bias toward continuous motion rather than jumps in every dimension. You have to work to make things disjunct. You can do it, but the natural biases are for things to be relatively continuous, for melodies to be on the stepwise side rather than the bizarre leap side.
Well, I think we should give it the Damien test.
Oh, good. Here we go. Where is it?
Well, it's hiding on a disc someplace.
You're listening to the second section of Cavus Muris, the first piece Laurie Spiegel issued that was created with Music Mouse. Shall we introduce what's about to happen?
Go right ahead. I don't remember much of it.
Well, we both tried Music Mouse. One of us successful and one not. Let's just go back to the music.
Wasn't Leon Trotsky sure?
Just reading about it, him in the book of Lenin.
Trotsky or Lenin?
Both. Lenin.
Lenin. Everybody. He knew everybody.
That's right. Slonimsky knew everybody. Absolutely. Did you
read this? This is one that will get you in trouble too. If we get around to discussing informational economies and all of that stuff, Marx is one of my idols too.
Oh no.
Groucho, Chico, you like Zeppo?
Zeppo.
Both Marxists, Groucho and Karl. I don't know who's funnier. Well, let's see.
Who's the other Karl Marx, too?
In fact, one of the names we were thinking of for the dog was Marx, because then depending upon how he was acting, we could either call him a great thinker, or we could call him, like, a total nutcase off the deep end. No, I grew up on Groucho Marx. I remember the duck coming down. You know.
Oh, the duck, yes. The duck. You bet your life. Da, ba, ba, da, ba.
Yeah.
What's the secret word?
Duck.
Ha, Fiji dog.
Yeah, your stuff is very, It's funny. It's like it comes from a barren kind of landscape, and yet your life and your vibes don't feel that way at all. You have a lot of mellowness and warmth in you. And
you mean the music doesn't sound that way?
Well,
yeah.
Well, let's get rid of the personal conversation
this
there. Compliments
psychoanalysis
are not...
Psychoanalysis has no
being, purpose for being.
None whatsoever. Let's just move ahead and get past that personal stuff. In the meantime, listen to the first of the last of three Sonic Spaces.
Thank you.
Now, there's one minor problem with your Music Mouse.
I
understand that this is not IBM compatible, and our radio program is IBM compatible. We do not run Macintosh equipment, nor do we give it more than a cursory mention, ever. That being said, we will attempt to make this work on our program, but again, there may be some auditory...
Listeners, please adjust your radios
now, again,
for Macintosh. The setting is in the back. Turn the unit around. You'll find a little switch. You flip that switch to the M position.
The M chip, yes.
M.
The V chip occurs in...
In vegetable-based computers.
Correct.
All biological computers require the V chip. We want you in M position.
The radio audience can't see this, but you might want to look at it in order to...
1988, this is a bit...
dated, but they're still in the same places.
All right.
You might be able to ask questions off it or whatever, possibly, but it's a keyboard map, and what I did was I mapped the keys on the keyboard as switches and faders. And you're using the switches and faders. You don't type things, but you use the keyboard as a controller, and then you play it by moving the mouse.
Just as an example of what those activities are, you have things such as pattern selectors and tempo selectors and breath controls and foot controls and such. That kind of, that's what you're talking about.
And types of harmonization,
mm-hmm.
diatonic, octatonic, all of those guys, and... different rhythmic things. Okay, there's some stuff. So, if you look at it in its simplest, you just move the mouse and it plays music.
This is a very reverberant mouse.
This is a variation on John Chowning's piano sound, which I like a lot. We're listening to a Yamaha DX racket. Have you ever crawled in underneath the grand piano to listen to it? The dog does that when I play.
Cool.
I used to do that, and it sounds wonderful. It sounds very reverberant. Okay, so I'm moving on the x-axis there, and I can add voices on the y-axis. Play it by just gently moving the mouse.
Yes.
Okay. And then, you know, you can do different things with it, like, let's try going chromatic and, let's try making everybody contrary motion and putting two voices on each axis. So we have two contrary moving pairs. They're chromatic, or what sounds better to me actually is octatonic. I like a lot.
Tell us what you mean by that.
The octatonic mode is used by Bartok used it, for example, and it's eight notes to the octave. The major and minor seconds alternating. Stravinsky used it. Now, the harmony, of course, tries its best to be meaningful harmony. This is New York out there. Now, you can change sounds by no reverb. It sounds a bit harsh, but this is just to show you and give you some idea what it is. And then if, let's see, which sound is this? I don't know which one it is. Aha. Okay. Here's one where this is the right. Now you notice that I'm changing the timbre by, these are faders, and the leaning on the left key of a fader pair fades it up.
You're holding down an N or an M key.
Yeah.
Using its faders there.
Right, and I mean the capital lever, the letter, capital letter punches it to the extreme, like maximum or minimum value. And you will increment and decrement by, you know, by just holding it. Here's it. I have several, I have like four different fader pairs here that are changing the timbre of this. A lot of those kinds of things in some of the music that I use this program on Unseen Worlds. Gives you a basic idea.
What I'm looking at this, on the screen as you're doing this is a list of the activities. I could see your phrases say harmonic mode, treatment, transposition.
Yeah, and you can see these changing. The keys QWERTY go across chromatic, octatonic, mid-eastern mode, diatonic, pentatonic, and quartal.
Uh-huh.
Those are harmonic modes and modalities, basically. And you want to be able to change in real time between them, and they're just they go from maximum resolution between an equal among an equal temperament octave 12, you know, chromatic at one end, to minimum, which is quartal. That is, they're in order by decreasing notes per octave, decreasing number of notes per octave resolution. So we go back to, let's just go back to like our little piano. What did I turn off here? Ah, everything. Let's see. This is a version of the program I don't have out yet. And it has in it a little thing called Why Not that says, give me a new idea. A brainstorming thing. Okay, now here we're in an alternative display. Put us at a transposition down in a pentatonic mode, contrary motion with automatic pattern generation going on. And two of the voices muted, which I can then punch in and out.
Okay.
And of course I can speed it up. Goes up to about 130 notes a second. Anyway, it gives you a basic idea, and because of nothing inherent in the program, but I seem to have gotten into another of these MIDI feedback loops, which I now have to break, so either that or the computer crashed. I don't know why.
Well, they don't do that. We know that this particular...
I think so, but happens all the time, particularly in versions that aren't released that I'm working on. This is the most recent compile, and...
And in fact, the computer did crash, and so we'll listen to The Hollows from Unseen Worlds until the computer gets back from crashing.
How will we know?
We'll know.
So anyway.
Well, you're back.
Well, I know. Well, it's been back for a while. I just didn't know if we should. Why don't we?
Can we give it to Damien? Test?
Yes, that's just what I was thinking. Why don't we do that? Let us see. Now there are two displays. This is the standard display that everyone knows, where you can really see what's going on. This is what I call a polyphonic cursor, and you see these are it points to the notes that you are playing and hearing. Except that to hear them, you have to have this. Then on this map, and you probably shouldn't even mess with these. These different variables. I sometimes refer to this as trio sonata format because it's an independently moving treble line with a bass line and two contrary moving inner voices that go contrary to the bass. And it tries to handle the harmony as well as it can, and then it will also do, you know, if you want to make lines out of things. I just hit the help key, and what that did was it put the fader pairs for these various controls up next to the variables so you can see what they are easily. And why don't you sit down here? Now, this is an innocent victim. And you want to move it very, you're right-handed or left-handed?
Left-handed.
Me too. Set up for you. Just move it very gently and...
You made a statement earlier that anyone who wanted to compose should be allowed to.
Anyone who wants to use it, it's not a question of allowed, should be able to.
We've had a number of guests on our show who I think their performances would dispute that statement.
Oh.
We won't name them, but...
You fitted it down to the point where you can't hear it. So this is Damien performing on Music Mouse, which he's never seen before a few minutes ago. And
what
you just
you? Oh that's
what did you just hit?
I hit you.
Oh, you went to a different sound that maybe had a long attack and needed to be played more slowly or something.
I don't believe it's slow.
You want to be faster? The plus minus keys are tempo.
Oh, alright.
And here's your tempo display. And you have two tempos available on a toggle so that you can change one while the other one is active and then suddenly switch to it. The one that has the equal sign is the active one. So
harmonic mode.
can see how it's this makes it easy to make music, and you're thinking on a compositional level. The decisions you're making while you're playing it are, do I want to go over to this kind of character instead? Would I perhaps like a sound with a little sharper attack? Let's bring up more sustain. Let's see, where is it? I can't remember elsewhere. Or would you perhaps like more staccato? Oh, they're too short for staccato. What sound? Oh, you're on sound. That's better for high speeds, for sharp attack. Yeah, it makes it ridiculously easy. I got a letter from someone, a professor at a fairly well-known musical college once, complaining that after his students had been given this software to work with, he had a hard time. I'm trying to talk in the pauses, but there aren't enough. He had a hard time telling whether his students deserved the A or whether they just did this music, this composing using this software, and it really made it hard to evaluate people, which basically for me calls into question the wisdom of trying to evaluate people in music. But for him, called into question this type of software. Because after all, for him, it's more important to be able to weed out as many undeserving, untalented people as possible. Whereas for me, the goal is that everybody who wishes to express themselves in sound certainly ought to be able to with the technology that we have these days. And that includes making it easier for myself. Not that I don't do it the hard way still. The last piece I wrote was a more or less by hand thing for solo French double harpsichord. Yeah, I can give you a tape of it. So I think he likes it. Does it pass the Gemian test?
It does. It has very mouse-like characteristics, and I do have a propensity for
rodents.
I do.
Me too. It's just good. Now, a lot of people say that it's like me, but I've heard a tremendous number of things come out of this program that I would have just never done or never thought of. For example, it was like a knockout to me the first time I saw someone using it to control a drum machine. And people use it for rock and roll, and I cannot imagine how, but they do, and, I don't know. Oh, yeah, when it puts the numerals on the staff, those are the voice numbers, voices 1 through 4, so that you can see which ones they are when they cross and stuff. You get to play it too, you know. Questions? Comments?
Does it come in blue?
Mm-hmm. I wish, but it's a grayscale monitor. Only if you play blues. He keeps hitting the give me a new idea button. And, you can hear there is a bias towards stepwise motion, toward fades rather than leaps in terms of all of the dimensions.
You mentioned that there was a way to get around that.
Hold the button down and you can go under notes and come up someplace. So you can't really see with this display what they are as well as if you look at it like this and put it back to this one, then you can go to whatever note. Oh, there's a half legato mode that holds it just for the duration of one note as opposed to either making them all uniform or staccato, or so that as you slow it down, they'll last proportionally longer. As you speed it up, they'll get shorter. I think you're off the deep end in subsonics there. Is this picking up on the headphones there? And I always stuck a note on the Yamaha. It can be released easily by guys like that. I hit the wrong note. I mean, I hit the wrong key. Because I'm not in front of the keyboard. You are.
From a harmonic algorithm, the name of that piece from Unseen Worlds by Laurie Spiegel. That's part two of our marathon with Laurie.
Hi there. And you say all we have left is mousing?
We have mousing. We have the conclusion, your virtuosic improvisation using Music Mouse, and then finishing up with the non-intuitive, intellectually bound, uncompromisingly rear area compulsive Calvos attempting to use a program which does not let him be in control.
That's it. It did not want to let you compose. It wanted you to follow its parameters, stay within them, and
it made me want to sound like Laurie.
See? Yes.
And now I do.
Boy.
Birthday boy.
Yeah. Mr. Zappa, Francis
yes.
Zappa.
Francis Zappa. And that goes along with our theme of insects, you know, as in Bug Zappa.
Of course.
Of course.
Yes.
easily done. So where shall we start? What do you think we should roll off first in the old Zappa world?
I think something orchestral, something that makes him look like a composer, which he was.
Well, yeah, should we tell a little bit? Yeah, maybe we should. Frank Zappa had always wanted to do the giant orchestral pieces and chamber pieces from his early days. He composed with pen and ink on paper, as he would say, millions of notes, just a page black with notes. And he has an autobiography called The Real Frank Zappa Book, which is a monumental piece of writing. It's very tongue-in-cheek in a lot of ways, very funny, as Zappa always was, but hidden in the book, and sometimes not hidden, are places of incredible wisdom. When he talks about what it's like to be a classical, as it were, a concert composer in the modern era in America, he is every bit as enthusiastic and bitter as any other composer ever was. And in fact, one of the reasons he did pop was to help him support the penchant for that. For example, hiring the London Symphony Orchestra to do one of his pieces. He got no respect there either, you know, as far as any other composer is.
I agree, absolutely. And I think you have something from the Hot Rats album that will...
Yeah, the very famous Peaches and Regalia. This is probably a piece that shows off Zappa's mixing of the pop idiom and sort of classical ideas and his great heroes, Stravinsky and Verez. All in sort of one little package. And then we'll go on to some of his concert pieces, some of his more famous pop tunes, some from his latter jazz influence stuff, things that he was exclusively doing with the synclavier, all kinds of stuff. Let's have a mix
Wonderful.
Of Zappa's, our view of Zappa's top tunes. May not match with yours, but it sure is going to be Zappa, no matter how you look at it.
Peaches and Regalia.
Thank you.
You almost can't get enough of this guy.
That's right. Frank Zappa, the composer of many genres, and nifty guy, and taker honor of the Senate committee and Tipper Gore and her crew.
That's right. No one has done it since, I guess.
Certainly not. Listening to It Must Be a Camel from Hot Rats. Before that, A Little Tiny Thing, King Kong, version 5.
From Uncle Meat. Also the movie, which was released at one time.
And then before that, the Cincinnati Winds playing the Dog Breath Variations.
Well played, I thought. I'd like their interpretation.
In the Spirit.
Oh, and followed preceded by the Eric Dolphy Memorial Barbecue.
And you said something you would have liked to have written before that.
Oh, that's right. The little piano interlude to...
Little... House.
Little house I used to live
yes.
in. Right, from Riesel's Whip. Riesel's Whip, my flesh. Riesel's Whip.
Before that, again, the Cincinnati Winds playing Envelopes. And then one of my favorites from Jazz from Hell, Beltway Bandits.
Which you wish you had written.
I certainly do. As a matter of fact, there's a part of it that I may have written, but it just didn't happen to have his name on it. The last few notes. And before that, a little bit of Igor's Boogie, Phase 1, from Burnt Weenie Sandwich. That's the name of that album.
Oh, so that's where, yes, not Riesel's Whipped, but Burnt Weenie had the piano bit.
Little House, right. And we started out with the classic mélange, the classic goods of deliciousness served for dessert, Peaches and Regalia.
A classic. It is with us, too, and hopefully with you, our listening audience.
And our listening audience will be able to hear us again next week, conclude our marathon with Laurie Spiegel, and we'll have new releases next week because we'll have additional time because our interview will only be about a half hour. So we'll have new releases, pieces we've just received from Carson Keevman and Paul Lansky and Eleanor Hovda and Ernesto Diaz Infante. So, till next week.
And if anyone wants to send a Christmas or holiday greeting to us in the form of a a recording, a CD, we'd be happy to accept it and maybe even play it over the air.
Or use it as a coaster!
Yes!
That's the Calvis and Damien show for today.
A production of Multimedia.